Welcome back to part two of Critical Race Theory with Shara Stone on criminal justice knowledge.
How critical race theory explains crime. I guess you're speaking of that a little bit, of how if an individual is white, they're way more less likely or not likely at all to be stopped by police or arrested for a certain crime, whereas someone of color might have a different experience, or do have a different experience.
Absolutely. And what we talk about is visibility. Mm-hmm. Right? We talk about how the law is constructed around public and private space, for example, and where do the police, mm-hmm. are agents of the law, mm-hmm. Where are they able to take control and to take charge? It's in public spaces, not in private spaces. So we talk about how the law itself changes based on what our current conceptions are. So back in the 80s, back in the 70s, we didn't talk about the drug war, mm-hmm. for example,
mm-hmm. yeah.
until Richard Nixon decided that he needed to shut down the hippie movement and at the right. same time shut down the civil rights movement, the black mm-hmm. movement, and very carefully targeted drug legislation to be harsher on pot and crack cocaine than mm-hmm. it was on any other type of drug.
Right.
Right. So thereby criminalizing the hippie movement, criminalizing the civil rights movement, and that was the law.
Yep.
Right. But making exempt or not as critical in terms of what we needed to focus on.
Right.
The other drugs that might be used or might be heavily marketed in other communities.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So how is the law constructed? Where are we greatest able to enforce the law? Who is most visible to us mm-hmm. in terms of criminal activity?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, critical race theory will ask those questions
mm-hmm.
to encourage us to think about: is it really that there is a difference in criminal activity across cultures or across races or across communities? Or
right.
is it just that we have constructed the law to ensure that certain individuals and certain groups of people are more likely to be to come in contact with the law and therefore more likely to be charged with a crime
mm-hmm.
and therefore more likely to be convicted of a crime?
Right.
And therefore more likely to end up in jail, end up with a criminal record, then get released back into our communities as criminals.
Right.
Okay, so if I can give you an example, I want you to think about a school in an affluent neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
right? Where you're talking about a high school in an affluent neighborhood, where we're talking about people who are, millionaires, billionaires, where where mom, dad, or both work on Bay Street,
mm-hmm.
either in the legal community or they work in hospitals, not as nurses but as doctors and as
right.
specialists, where they work on Bay Street providing financial advice to other people
mm-hmm.
who have lots of money.
Yeah.
Okay. So a very, very, very affluent neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I want you to think about a neighborhood potentially on the other side, of a street, very close by, that is not as affluent.
Mm-hmm.
Where there are, where you can find Ontario or Toronto housing, where you see neighborhood multi-family dwellings, large,
mm-hmm.
Large apartment buildings,
right.
for example. So I want you to sort of get have those two images in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, which high school do you think has the greater drug problem?
Probably the high school that's not in the affluent community, the one that's in the community with the social housing.
And what are the kids buying that are going to school around this more marginalized neighborhood?
Probably cheaper drugs, possibly pot. I can't think of any cheaper drugs.
Okay.
So, like
so let's stay with pot, because that's a good one. So we're talking about the kids in social housing, potentially purchasing pot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do we think that the school the more affluent school mm-hmm. doesn't have a drug problem?
Definitely not. They 100% probably do.
And what are the kids purchasing there?
Probably more. They have more money, some more expensive things: cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, things like that.
So, who has the greater drug problem?
you would think either equal or even more of the affluent neighborhood might have even more of a drug problem.
But where do we target?
The neighborhood with social housing and kids that are living in social housing.
Okay, so, and why are we doing that? Why is that what we're targeting as opposed to the more affluent neighborhood?
The individuals that are living in a social housing neighborhood or communities that have social housing have to go to public spaces to do their drugs, to smoke their drugs, to do what they're doing, whereas the affluent kids are able to stay at home in their large backyards and their pool houses and their sheds and be hidden behind fences and closed doors.
And how does that impact the way that we police, for example?
It would make it seem as though one that other community that has social housing that is maybe a community in transition, that that community is more crime-ridden. In the affluent community, there's no crime.
There's no crime.
Safe.
Okay. But why would the police choose? Okay, and I'm going to use that word very loosely. Why would the police choose? We know we got a drug problem in both schools. Why would the police choose to go to the less to the more marginalized community over the affluent community?
Because it's much easier for them to access those individuals, whereas the affluent communities, the kids there, they have to go through possibly parents that are lawyers or parents that have expensive lawyers that will be able to fight against it. They'll ask for search warrants.
Don't they need search warrants in the more marginalized communities?
What? They're in a public space, so they can visibly be able to see what they're doing.
So the law is constructed. This is how we talk about the social construction of the law. The law is constructed to protect those that have influence, affluence, and wealth.
Right.
At the expense of those who are less marginalized, because you're right, with the distinction is between that public and that private space.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what we see in the media is where the police are able to do their jobs most effectively,
right,
which is most effectively, again, in loosely term used loosely, but in more marginalized communities, because they can't get
exactly
to the more affluent communities.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that the crimes aren't happening in both communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about how is the law constructed to benefit those with privilege and those in power at the expense of everyone else.
Right. So how would critical race theorists have us think about crime, or say that we're how we think about crime?
Okay. So if I can use an example from Dr. Scott Wortley and Dr. Owasi Owosu-Bempe from U of T, they ask us to think about who our foremost notorious criminals are.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, when they ask that question, and in their research, when they ask that question, the answers that come up will be Colonel Russell, Paul Bernardo, Robert Picton, Luca McNaughta, individuals, and they'll say, yes, exactly, those are our most notorious criminals. But how many of them are black?
None. There are all four.
And yet our conception of crime and our perception of crime is heavily rooted in the whole notion of black criminality.
Mm-hmm.
But our notorious criminals,
right,
not black. So critical race theory would ask you to ask yourself why.
Mm-hmm.
Why, if our notorious criminals are not black, why is our perception and our fear rooted in the black community? And again, we come back to the social construction of race, right? And how race has been used as the basis to, you know, at one time during slavery, you know, the conception of the black man was of the, you know, was the soft, you know, hardworking-ish individual who was yesa, dosa, yes massa.
Right.
Right. And that was how we thought about it. But oh my God, after slavery ended, we had to change that conception.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to create these notions that that blackness was about criminality, that it was about cruelty and brutality, that about lack of trust, and there's been papers written about the construction of the black rapist being after the white woman, and this whole notion of blackness constructed. Mm-hmm. How does that then influence crime? If that's our common understanding, right. If we're really truthful with ourselves, mm-hmm. about what we think about crime,
yep.
and who we think perpetrates crime,
mm-hmm.
right? But those are not our notorious killers. Those are not our notorious criminals. If we think about corporate crime, for example,
mm-hmm.
While we, as a whole, don't go after people of the upper classes when mm-hmm. it comes to criminal activity.
Right.
This is where that whole, again, where those notions of intersectionality come in.
Why, in a critical race theorist point of view or perspective, mm-hmm. With the theory itself, why would an individual commit a crime, or why would they engage in criminal behavior?
So imagine for a moment that every time you walk into a grocery store,
mm-hmm.
the eyes are on you.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you go to a convenience store, the eyes are on you. You go shopping for a tank top, and there are three salespeople around you constantly. What message do you get?
You get that you're a criminal.
Okay. So this is where it draws on principles, for example, of symbolic interactionism,
mm-hmm.
right? And labeling theory. Because if you are constantly labeled as something,
right?
How hard do you have to fight to not become that label?
It takes a lot of effort.
Now, combine that with a lack of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Who's more likely to get hired for a job? A young black man mm-hmm. or a young white man?
Young white man.
I'm not saying that it's easy for a young white man to get a job. So if you're talking about limited opportunity and you're labeled,
mm-hmm.
add into that you are raised in a setting where potentially your caregiver works two jobs
mm-hmm.
to put food on the table. If that caregiver is working two jobs to put food on the table, how much time is that caregiver spending with you?
Very little, if
Very
any.
Little. Okay. So then we talk about supervision.
Mm-hmm.
But that becomes a double-edged sword. Because if that caregiver stays home to ensure that there's supervision, they can't put food on the table.
Right.
If they can't put food on the table, CAS comes in mm-hmm. and says you are neglecting your child and takes your child away.
Yep.
So
what
are you expected to do?
Exactly.
Right? So someone comes up to you and says, can you just stand there? I'll give you $10 if you stand there. All you got to do is stand there for 10 minutes and I'll give you $10.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking, young person?
I'm thinking $10 just for standing there.
$10 just for standing there.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's $10 for just standing there for 10 minutes. And, next week it's $100 for standing there for half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you helping out your family here?
By getting money.
By getting
yeah.
money. You're being entrepreneurial. Yeah. You're being really kind of cool here, right?
Yeah.
Helping out mom, and anything you get, you put on the table. Mom goes, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And you go, oh, I don't know why reasons. But anyway, at the same time, it's like, I'm your friend. I'm here to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to support you in doing whatever it is that you need to do. And then I'll offer you $1,000 for carrying a package from here down the street. Are you going to take it, or are you going to walk away?
Probably going to take it.
So you get an idea of some of the factors, because again, intersectionality is not just about race.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about family structure,
mm-hmm.
and it's about class, and it's about income,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's about ability, because all of those
mm-hmm.
factor into this beautiful perception of what supervision should look like.
Right.
Right? And who's a good supervisor, and who's
yep.
not a good supervisor.
Exactly.
Right? There is an incredible movie.
I Am
Sean
Sam.
I Am Sam.
I love
Thank
that's
you
a
very
great
much.
Movie. Yeah.
Okay. Because one of the things that's beautiful about I Am Sam
mm-hmm.
is it really lays bare this reality
mm-hmm.
of who's going to get targeted. Okay. Because here's Sam. Those of you who haven't seen it, Sam is developmentally delayed.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a daughter. And it comes a point where his daughter's intellect is greater than his. And then the school system gets involved and says, you can't parent this child effectively because you're not as smart as she is, and you never can be, and she's far surpassed you, and she's holding herself back now because she doesn't want to be smarter than her dad. And don't you think it's in your daughter's best interests to give up your child so that she can have a better life? And he says no, and he fights for the right to keep his child. Now the contrast here is the lawyer that he eventually manages to hire has a son whom she never sees, who gets himself into trouble, who's doing all kinds of stuff, but how come nobody's looking at her parenting and her capacities and whether or not that child should be existing in that context?
Right.
Just gives you that one, and again, another way of sort of thinking critically about who's being targeted.
Exactly.
Who do our systems go after?
Right.
Right?
I mean, you've given us so much to think about, and so much, which is really great, because I think the biggest thing is that we as you've said, that we critically think about our surroundings, we critically think about our society and the way that the law intersects with our lives and the lives of everyone else around us.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for coming on today, Shara. It's incredibly interesting discussion, and we do have some more resources and links if you want to find out more as well that Shara has provided to us. Until next time, I'm Natalie Miller, and this has been Criminal Justice Knowledge.